Well, welcome to this week's version of our podcast based upon our newsletter that we record on a weekly basis. The newsletter is chock and block full of information. So if you want to get a lot more color about what we're speaking about today, please feel free to head over to our newsletter, tell your friends about it, subscribe to it, and let's grow the community around the issues that we're talking about. The week, the Dow Jones up 1.4%, S&P up 1.38%, the NASDAQ up 1.12%. We hand over to Europe. Eurostoxx 50 is up 0.42%. And that just kind of gives an indication of where the world is at the moment. We're going to be talking about China a little bit later in relation to India. But if you look across into the Chinese market, not a happy place. Over the last year, China deeply into negative space. The Shanghai index down 16.3%, and the Hang Seng, which was really the stalwart of the open market in the Chinese world, down 28.29%. This week, we're going to be talking about India. As I said just now, we're going to be talking about the jobs report in the United States, China, as I said, SA inflation, and also just market expectations around the earnings that we've seen in the last week. Dawn, a very, very interesting week in markets. The jobs report in the United States continue to be robust. It doesn't look bad. And it continues to show an economy growing, right?
Yes, it does. And, you know, as I've said before, this is likely to stand in Biden's favor. Obviously, coming into the absolute thick of the primaries and the elections coming down the pipe, and obviously, but with the whole world at the back of its mind, must have this concern that we have two octogenarians fighting for presidential candidacy. And just statistically, the chances of them living to the end of their term decreases by the minute. There are global concerns around that. And Kamala Harris is significantly disliked right across the board for some reason. I don't know. I think she's a perfectly acceptable vice president. And Trump hasn't said who he's going to make his vice president. If he was smart, he would probably have Nikki Haley. So, and this all plays into the mix, but a robust economy. And it looks like the US has dodged that soft landing bullet, even let alone a full blown recession. And really, they've taken the interest rate hikes, which have been in orders of magnitude, you know, up sort of 300-400% off the lows on the chin and just carried on.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting. When you back test those numbers and you look at the impact of inflation and a hike in interest rates, and you look at the impact it has on markets, it should have a very decisive and discernible impact on markets on the downside. And yes, we've seen impact on the downside, but nothing to the degree of what history actually teaches. And that is why I think during 2023, a lot of people, a lot of market watchers were waiting for a much deeper bear market to kind of play itself out. And that's why if you look through 2023, you look through the news items, you would see on a continuous basis, the bears calling for a much lower market and a much lower market. But that just didn't materialize. Today, we're sitting with a market which is appreciated in value and is back again to levels kind of pre this whole crisis. As a matter of fact, it's interesting because this week I actually saw a news item. It was late Friday where I saw one of the very large investment banks globally where the investment head of investments was now really standing down because he's saying, I don't know what's going on. I actually, quite frankly, I have no idea what is going on. And I was calling for a much deeper bear market. And actually, based upon history, he wouldn't have been wrong. But given what we have today with this great monetization world that's busy playing itself out, everybody seems to, you can't just follow the past and hope that it's going to be right.
You know, it makes it very difficult for investors. I mean, if the pundits, the people who've got their nose to the ground, who are watching this on an hourly, minute-by-minute basis, are throwing their hands in the air and saying, we just don't know what's happening here. You know, then everyday investors haven't got a chance. And I think the sort of the moral of the story is, in times like this, is to be diversified, to look at preserving capital, to try and reduce some of the volatility, to try and get exposure all over the world. and see this through. There's no point in getting out of the market. You might just miss some of those massive just jumps that we've seen in South Africa market, let alone in the offshore market. You know, it's a very difficult time, and none of us has a crystal ball, and we can't look to the past in order to predict the future at this point in time. It's a great unknown, and our job is, you know, looking after people's wealth is to just try and pick up the wins where we can, but also try and look out for the pitfalls and just try to make sure the capital isn't lost in the interim.
Well, Dawn, it brings an interesting human psychology to play, because a lot of people today kind of look and say, look, I know how to pick stocks. I'm a doctor, but I know how to pick stocks. Or, I run an industrial company, but I'm very, very good at picking stocks. And you say to them, why do you think that? You say, well, because I've got it right. Last 5 years, I put money into large tech companies and I've made over 100 or 200% of my money. What can go wrong? What are you, as a professional investor, going to do in order to make my returns better? I don't think you can. I'm the expert at this. But I think what is lost in that debate is the fact that we're living through a very specific type of market. And this market favors certain companies and it doesn't favor other types of companies. It favors a certain type of environment and the thought process, and that has to fit within the ideology of great monetization. So a good example would be large tech companies. They thrive in this type of environment. Now, at some point they won't thrive, but at this stage they are thriving. And if you decided to buy Meta, which is the parent of Facebook, during its doldrum days only a couple of years ago, you would have looked like an absolute hero. No different to Netflix. Netflix had a subscriber problem last year. If you bought it in the doldrums and you just put your money in, well, today you've made a ton of money out of Netflix. It doesn't make you a superior investor. It just makes you lucky potentially. And this is where the difference between luck and skill comes in. Luck you can measure over very short periods of time. Skill is something that you measure over very long periods of time. And at the moment, I think a lot of investors are confused between luck and skill and what the differences are. And you'll only know that when the market conditions change. But for now, as I said last week, we're going through this world of monetization. Monetization means that more and more debt is joining the system. They are monetizing that debt. The world governments are monetizing that debt by not buying back the debt issuance, but literally rolling them forward into new issuances. And as that happens, that potentially pushes interest rates lower, and that's generally quite good for equities. So it doesn't make the job of professional money management any easier. I think it probably complicates things and it makes things much more hazy than what they were before. But that's the world that we live in.
And to compound things, there's the whole deglobalization or onshoring or de-risking or decoupling, whatever they want to call it. In other words, you know, at the end of the day, getting the hell out of China. In most cases, that's what it is. And I was actually this morning, and we're talking Sunday morning, what Hillary Rodham Clinton on Bloomberg giving a very, very good speech in terms of her understanding, you know, and as you know, during the Obama administration, she was involved in foreign affairs, and so her understanding of international markets is really good. And she said, and I have sort of paraphrased it a little bit in the newsletter, is that the difference between, you know, dealing with China then, you know, which is now what, 15 years ago or so, and China now, is that Xi is now the dictator. He is not just the head of the Communist Party. He's positioning himself as a dictator. They're done away with terms, and it is not going to be any kind of refreshing or evolution of the communist philosophy that we've seen happen over decades. It has been stuck on Xi, and it looks like it's going to be stuck there for the foreseeable future. And he's harking back to the days of Mao. So, and that is a huge difference. And that was a bit of a light bulb moment for me, is that this is what the difference is between, because, you know, I've been interested in China, but traveled to China for years, you know, for now over 2 decades. And this really sort of really increased my understanding of what it is about China that all of us are getting worried about and why the economy is floundering and why everybody's getting out.
Well, I think in an open economy where there's a free market, there's a price. One can kind of ascertain what is the price to pay for a risk asset, for a perpetual risk asset, for a mid-cap or a small-cap risk asset. You can price it on a continuum relative to their peers globally. But once you have government interference, once you're sitting in a centrally planned world, one is very uncertain as to what that value is. And if one just looks at the values, I mean, let's just look at these two. China, so I spoke about that just now, Dow Jones Shanghai, last 3 years is down 30%. But yet in India, the BSE Sensex is up 42%. That shows you the difference between policy certainty. You get policy certainty right, money finds your country and it finds the capital and it finds the opportunities. And now you've created the environment. And that is exactly the same. That is exactly the thing that Xi Jinping and his party, the Red Party, is literally not trying to achieve right now. They're trying to create this centrally planned system where capitalism can somehow, in some way, operate. And you can see that people are, and investors are just turning cold against it. They're just saying, listen, I don't know what to pay for these assets. They're cheap. I mean, I've seen valuations for Alibaba and people continue to, talk about the valuations for Alibaba. But I keep on asking them, but what is the true value within a centrally planned system? I don't know what the value is. And nobody knows what the value is in the centrally planned system. Talking about India, let's just talk a little bit about India, because I think that this is serious competition for emerging markets, which includes South Africa, with a lot of policy uncertainty. There's lots and lots of policy certainty. In 2016, Prime Minister Narendra Modi stunned markets by banning high-value currency notes overnight. I mean, this had to do with their company, Paytm, and its creation and so on. Do you want to just take us a little bit about, through that? Because that's something that you write about quite a lot in this week's newsletter.
This is a very interesting space, and without being unkind, it's a case study in opportunism to a large extent, right? Now, Paytm was started off as really a system to buy mobile data time, like there are thousands of them, and in this country, like you can get it everywhere, and that's where it started. India's gone through a pretty painful evolution in terms of its economy. It has gone from a really fairly closed economy, not communism as such, but a closed economy where it was very difficult for international investors to break into that market, to what it is today. This banning of those high notes, I mean, I remember when it happening, I mean, there was rioting on the streets, essentially, is because there was one, a lot of fraud, a lot of counterfeiting happening with those high notes, and people were sitting on them. And you weren't getting the sort of money flow throughout India. So Paytm sort of identified fairly astutely a gap in the market to say, where everybody was saying, oh God, this is an absolute disaster, saying, oh no, this is the best thing that's ever happened, and built his platform to produce an app that did all these transactions, and it's been wildly successful. Unfortunately, like you find all over the world, regulations did not keep up with the rate of evolution of this new technology. We're seeing it with Bitcoin all over the world, that regulation is fumbling all over itself, trying to catch up with the regulations. But in India, because they were, to all intents and purposes, a little bit behind in that kind of thing, it didn't catch up. And as a result, it was unregulated. There was not compliance. Obviously, without them saying so blatantly, corruption involved. And this is very interesting. But now they've sort of caught up with this and put their foot down, which is really a change for that whole Indian regulatory system, is to say, yes, I know you're wildly successful and you did step into the breach, but now we're going to stop this. And it wiped, what was it, like $2 billion off their market cap in one day. So this is an evolving story, and I think we can continue to talk about it. But from a sheer case study of an entrepreneur seeing a gap in the market
Yeah, for
and
sure.
going for it, it's mind-boggling. And you're getting a lot of, in India, you see a lot of that entrepreneurial spirit. Yes, of course, They are also known perhaps for corruption, and their
Yeah, sure.
taxation system is a bit hit and miss and things like that. But this, especially as they start to take on more of the market share that's being lost from China, it's going to be very interesting to see how they navigate all of this without it becoming a dog's breakfast.
But no different to what the US went through in the 1920s and the 1930s. I mean, the wild days of JP Morgan trying to do deals in the US and across the Atlantic, those things are legendary, you know. And if you look at how the large investment banks were built and the financial services sector in the United States, this is not uncommon for an industry that's busy growing. But at least they're growing in a free market, or they're growing in something which has been approximated by a free market. And look, they've got competition. I mean, look at what Javier Milei is busy doing in Argentina just this week. I mean, I've seen the list of stuff that this guy has done and he's pushed through parliament. He's deregulating literally everything, and he's laying off people in government departments, trying to make sure that the place is right sized so that, it can just operate so that they can become more competitive. And I think this is the one thing that people just don't understand, or countries probably don't understand, is that they are competing for travel dollars. They're competing for, or travel rands. You're competing for business dollars globally. It's a competitive world, and you need to be able to stand on your feet on the global stage, and you need to be able to say, well, listen, I can stand on my own feet. I'm able to operate. If you look at South Africa, the government employee wage bill in South Africa skyrocketed from 408 billion in 2013, 2014 to 724 billion today. That's massive. You're not showing that you are serious about South Africa Incorporated. You're not serious about it. You basically just have a gravy train, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, I did put some other statistics in terms of the South African government salary bill in there, and it's astounding. The average salary of a government employee is double, almost double, what it is in the private sector. That's insane. That is absolutely insane that's happening. And the increases that they get are usually above inflation. And of course, that compounds and puts the whole thing out of whack. Talk about Milei, right sizing Argentinian government, that we need that desperately. Eskom needs to shed 20,000 people in order to even start getting back to productivity levels pre-Jacob Zuma, for example. And that's just one of the areas. I mean, I had the fortune slash misfortune of going into SARS recently. They are still nowhere near back to pandemic levels. And I went at a busy time of the day and a busy time of the year. Every single government department is bloated at the end of the day. Obviously, one of my other concerns, and I'm actually just writing a blog at the moment, and for those of my listeners who don't perhaps know, my blogs are all go up onto MoneyWeb, but I'm writing a revised blog on the NHI because that has come back onto the radar. There is the expectation that Cyril might sign the NHI document this week.
Good luck with that. Good luck with finding the money, though, for it, because signing it and finding the money are things, eh? Right?
Yeah, the thing is, there's good news and bad news about that. There is a bevy of lawyers in the private sector who've been waiting for it to get signed so that they can make representations to the Constitutional Court because it breaches constitutional law in several areas, at least six or seven different areas. So it is going to be stuck in the Constitutional Court for the foreseeable future. But it has to be a law before you can have a constitutional challenge against it. So that they've done challenges, but they've come up to the point where until it is a law, you can't make a constitutional challenge to it. So it is going to be very interesting. But I think that it's one of the reasons that I'm rewriting the blog. I've been writing blogs on and off about the evolution of the NHI for the last 7 years. And we can probably talk about that next week, or we maybe do a podcast specifically on it. But this, to me, and to a lot of the clients that I talk about, is one of these triggers that is probably more significant even than 1994. If you really understand the NHI and the way that it's been put together at the moment, where not only will medical aids not exist, all doctors will have to work for the government at government rates. They will not be allowed to have private practices outside of the government. If it is implemented as it is at the moment, we will see a mass exodus of medical staff, and we will see a mass exodus of taxpayers are
Literally got
concerned
one
about
free.
their, of their health. But bottom line is dying unnecessarily prematurely because you've got becomes a almost like a lottery as to where you end up.
Look, I'm convinced that South Africa at some point, and I don't know what the timing for this looks like, is we will find our Argentinian moment. I can already see it happening in the political rhetoric that comes out from opposition parties. Whereas previously we only had the official opposition really standing against the policies of the ruling party. Today, there are people coming up with alternatives, and different types of answers. They don't call themselves necessarily political parties. They are political parties, but they're trying to find different inclusive answers that takes a broader South Africa into consideration. Here's a good example. Look at Rise Mzansi. You might like him, you might not like him, but look at the slogan. The slogan says, 2024 is our 1994. What does it say? It's not saying, listen, we hate the ruling party and we don't like what they do. They're saying, listen, let's find different answers. And what are those answers? And let's try and formulate those answers. So I'm convinced South Africa will have an Argentinian moment. The question just is, when does that happen? If you listen to Javier Milei speak about Argentina, you can see they went through absolute years and years and years and years and years of malaise where things just broke and broke even further and then broke even further before they got to a point where people realized that they have to make a different decision. And let's face it, if tomorrow there's a new way in South Africa and they right size government departments, that's going to have pain involved, Dawn. That's not going to be easy, that's going to be tough. And there's going to be opportunity that comes from that, but that only happens in the future. It doesn't happen immediately. And that is the, and I think there's a lot of fear as well. I mean, I've spoken to people at the very large parastatals, large institutions, and they'll say to us, we could do this and we could do that. But, really speaking, I feel like a victim because I've now worked for the organization and I no longer can work for the organization. I said, well, are you a victim or are you being given an opportunity? Which way are you going to see this? Which way do you wish to see this? And once you start talking to people about that, then people start saying, well, perhaps I should be thinking differently about this. And that's all got to do with mindset and everything. I think there's almost a political poison that has infiltrated a lot of South Africans where they believe that the state somehow should be the owner of everything and that the state should provide. And that is wrong. That's not the way that successful economies work globally.
Colby, I think it goes even further than that. I mean, I saw on the socials over the last couple of weeks that you've got over 800 young doctors who've now finished their practical sessions that they have to do with the government, complaining bitterly that the government aren't providing them jobs because the way the law is written at the moment, if they want to specialize, it has to be done through a government institution. Now, that's insane. There's more than enough private institutions that would be able to pick up that slack, adequately train, not, doctors, vets, physiotherapists, right up to specialists, but they're not allowed to, right? So
Absolutely.
now we've got a health care system that is in disarray, and we've got 800 doctors that do not have jobs.
And what a waste. What a
What
waste in
a
South
waste.
Africa, right?
What a waste.
Where there are people that are in dire need today of medical assistance. And yet it's just absolutely sacrilege that these people can't, aren't being utilized. But that's the story of South Africa. That's the story of the growing pains of trying to compete. And then once you've deregulated all of this, and once you're actually at a point where you can now start saying, okay, well, at least we're rid of the poison of the past, then the question becomes, how do you now compete? Because now you've got to compete against India. You've got to compete against Argentina, who have already figured this out. And you've got to go stand on the world stage and you've got to be able to stand up for yourself and say, rather give us your dollars. Don't put your dollars in India. And that's going to be a tough sell. Because if you're a global fund manager right now, and you've got to do an emerging market allocation, do you give money to South Africa? No, you put it all in India. And your compliance officer comes to you and says, Have you made an emerging market? Have you taken emerging market exposure? You say, yes, I've put it all into India. And they're going to say, okay, fine. I'm quite happy with that. They're not going to say, but why did you not put money in South Africa? Nobody cares. And that's the other issue is that South Africa is growing up to become a country that is realizing that the Mandela magic is now no longer. He's a man that is in the history books and he'll always be part of the South African story, but there's no magic anymore. Nobody owes South Africa anything. South Africa's got to stand on the world stage and be counted. If he cannot be counted, then what have you got left?
Interestingly, Kobe, watching once again, you're mostly watching Bloomberg over the weekend, where there's been, some significant forums and that, is that Russia, India, and China to a certain extent are really starting to stand on their own and tell America and Europe to get lost, right? There was a very good documentary there on what is happening to Russian oil. They did some investigative journalism, and there's supposed to be a cap on Russian oil, but so that they can't buy more arms and that to annihilate Ukraine. But that there's just as much oil going out as there ever has been, and all that is happening is that it's going into the Mediterranean, getting put onto old ships, really going through the Suez and going to India and going to China, almost openly. It's like, so what are you going to do about it in America?
And I believe it's fine if a country wants to make those decisions. It's not a problem. They're a sovereign nation, they've got to make those decisions, but it has to be within the understanding of the ramifications for what it has for your global trade and the ramifications it has for your country and your people group. But if you are driven by ideology alone, when it comes to these decisions, you are going to find yourself terribly short when it comes to the real life capitalistic implications of what you've done, the rands and cents, the income statement of your country, because you're driven by ideology. But if a country can stand up and say, listen, I'm buying Russian oil because I believe it's cheap, and quite frankly, I can sell my goods and services to whatever country out there, and I'm quite happy to continue, and I don't care about the ramifications or I've taken care of the ramifications, then so be it. It's a free world out there. That's how countries should operate. And I think that South Africa, for now, is driven a lot about it. There's a lot of rhetoric that drives our decision making. It's got to do about the last 20 years. It's got to do with who and what were our friends during the apartheid era, and what should we do about that? But that's rhetoric. That is what drives the system. It's not real life implications that are driving those decision makings. And look, South Africa will grow up at some point. South Africa will have to come to that realization. That might be still a while. Let's see what the elections hold. It might be quite an interesting time for South Africa.
But, I mean, I hate being a doomsayer, but at the end of the day, and I like to think that African countries specifically, I mean, having lived all over Africa, that they hit rock bottom, they stop digging, and eventually they come out of it. We've seen it with Rwanda, we've seen it with East Africa, we've seen it with most of the countries. Zimbabwe is still digging. We're still digging. When do you stop digging? Because it's only when you stop digging that you can actually start coming out of it. I mean, Zimbabwe, their hole must be just about in Australia by now. Okay?
Well, this is the sad reality, is that we don't have a gauge as to when this will stop. And that's why I'm saying I'm convinced there'll be a moment, but when that happens, I quite frankly don't know. Well, listen, tell us what you think and reach out to us and talk to us about the South African Argentinian moment. That would be wonderful. I really look forward to that day. I think there'll be people will be dancing in the streets when something like that happens. This was week number five. Thank you for listening. Lots more in the newsletter. Head over to the newsletter, tell your friends about it. Thank you for listening.